everyone, and welcome to episode 124 of season 11 of Movie Ramen, the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off his 10-part stint, opening up each of these 10 parts of this series, is my good friend Jay Cluett from Deep Blue Sea Pod. Welcome back once again for your 10th time this season, Jay.
Thank you. You caught me just before my morning swim. Got me in just in time.
There you go. It's a good thing that you want to go swim, but what are you going to do after?
I guess some breakfast.
Okay.
After? I don't know. Exactly. No, I'm not going to New Jersey anytime soon.
Okay. Well, we'll figure that out. We'll figure that out.
I'll think about it.
So episode 124 begins with the title shot of part 10, which is known as Points, and ends with a group of soldiers walking forward. Again, we'll have to find out tomorrow what it is specifically they're about to do, but you know, they do have a bazooka. that's the hint we can give.
It's not gonna do much. They are off. Well, they've got one.
That's a separate issue, but they have a bazooka. And for actually the first time throughout this series, they do things a little differently here. You know, we don't have any of the you know, the men of Easy Company giving their perspective on things.
They save that for the end.
Yes. For some strange reason, they decided to do that. I don't know.
I think it works. I think it was a good decision. Why would they?
I think it's a great decision. Because at the end, they're able to finally give us something that they weren't able to give before that.
Yes.
Which is credits. You know, telling us who, well, no, telling us who is who.
Yeah, credits. They're crediting their people. They're saying this is this person.
But yeah, I like the way that, I mean, this one just jumps right into the opening credits of you know, with Michael Heyman's music and you know, all the names of the actors and things like that. But they don't give us any of the interviews here, and I think it's quite effective the way that they do it. And then, you know, it gives us a very nice pastoral viewpoint of things that are going on. And again, this is in contrast to everything that we've seen in the previous 9 parts. You know, everything was grim and gloomy and stuff like that. But here, this time, you know, they've given us something else. You know, they're just you know, we get to see a lake. That's shining on the sunlight of sunrise, basically.
Yeah, and if you look just in the distance, you can see Sam and Frodo heading off to Mordor. It looks exactly the same.
You have to look really, really carefully to see that, but yeah, it is.
But they're in there, little hobbits. Yeah.
Okay, if you know, if you can see them, that's good. yeah, especially considering the fact that when this came out. No one even had seen the Sam and Frodo that we all know.
They were filming it.
3 months for that.
Yeah,
they were filming it. No, my assumption is they'd finished filming by this point, but you know, but basically, no one had seen them on the screen besides maybe in trailers. And we get a shot on the screen telling us that it is July 1945, and we are in ZLMC, Austria.
Sure.
Once again, it's it has a famous lake there called known as Lake Zell, which my assumption is that is where Winters is having his little swim. There, the town has a population of about 10,000, and it's a prime destination for summer sports and winter skiing, and it's been popular for over 2 centuries for people to go to those places. So it makes sense that this is the area that Hitler would choose to have his little vacation spot.
Oh, it looks nice.
Yes, I doubt that they filmed it in that exact spot, but yeah. And again, it's nice to be there in the middle of 1945. You probably wouldn't want to be there a few months earlier. Probably not.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
And then, you know, besides seeing Sam and Frodo walking off in the distance, you know, we see Winters walking barefoot through the. Actually, that's something the Hobbit would do also. You know, walking to the woods, mm-hmm. to the edge of the lake. And we.
I don't think Damian Lewis would have made a good Hobbit.
No, I don't think so either. He's. I mean, I would say that.
I could see him in like the.
I would say he's a little too tall.
I could see him as Boromir. Yeah. But he could have been in the Sean Bean role, I think would have worked.
No, I don't think so. I think he's seen as being someone a little too too nice to play the role of Boromir. That's why Sean Bean was
great about
as Boromir, because he's on both sides. Maybe seeing him as Aragorn, possibly.
Sure. Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, Faramir could have worked, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Correct.
Maybe.
Okay, but it doesn't matter because you know, now we all know him as Dick Winters, or you know, see him in Homeland.
That guy from Billions.
Okay, I wouldn't say that.
Yes, sure.
I would go to Homeland first, but yeah.
I haven't seen Billions. I just know he's the guy. I didn't see Homeland. So I know he's the guy from those things.
Oh wow! So you should, if you can,
he's Steve McQueen from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That is true. If you have a chance, you should see the first season of Homeland. It's amazing.
I've heard it's good.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
There's too much. He's the bad guy from The Escapist.
And at this point, we get a narration from Winters, which is. Pretty much, it's been a while since we've had narration from Winters, so it's nice that they that this episode is centric on or that this part is centric on Winters. And he says it was more than 3 years since Lewis and Nixon and I decided to join the paratroopers, and more than a year since we'd gone to war, not knowing what would happen to us, how long we'd be fighting, where we'd end up. I certainly didn't expect to find myself in a place like this. And then from behind. We hear Nixon's voice, and he goes, "I thought it might be you." Winters looks at him and goes, "Morning." He goes, "Yeah, I heard reports of a red-headed Eskimo." Okay, do you have any idea why they would say that?
Because it's cold, I guess. It's July. Somebody willing to.
It's July. Why would it be so cold?
That's a good point. It's July. Eskimo. Yeah, I don't know where he's getting Eskimo from.
I mean, if he was pretending to be. A you know, if he was in the polar bear club, I can understand they would call him the red-headed Eskimo, you know.
Yeah.
But
he's not. He's just going for a morning swim in a lake that looks like
maybe it's chilly.
No, I don't know.
You know.
Maybe Nixon's drunk. Who knows?
I don't know. I mean, again, I think he's beyond beyond his drunkenness at this point. But I mean, doing a quick search on the term red-headed Eskimo, it's actually a political term, which doesn't make any sense. It's a colloquial U.S. political term referring to a legislative proposal tailored to benefit an extremely small or non-existent constituency. It's a metaphor for an obscure or highly specific legal provision. I don't know. Maybe the idea that he's the only one that can be that knows that it's best to go swimming at 6 o'clock in the morning, in Zelem Zoo. I don't know.
Never know.
I don't know. It's just a very strange comment for him to make.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. I got nothing.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I don't know. And I mean, sunrise back in July of 1945 in Zelem Z was at 5:14 a.m. So this has got to be really early because it does look like it's right around sunrise time. You know, so I guess it shows that you know, once again, that Winters is a man up at the crack of dawn,
clean shaven, going for a swim. Right.
And Nixon then continues and goes, "Thought I'd check it out. Winters, would you come to join me for a morning swim?" And Nixon just laughs. I guess, yeah, you know me so well. And then he hands him a package and goes, "Here, that's from Zelensky." Now, I love the fact that Zelensky is mentioned here, because, you know, as you know as well as I do, Zelensky was originally supposed to be played by who?
Connor Ratliff. There you go. He was fired for having his eyes were just not alive enough.
They were dead eyes. And
I like to think that they cast him in this episode. Like the files, the envelope that Nick's got, he got from Connor Ratliff off screen.
It's very possible. It's very possible. Now, I don't know if you noticed this when, you know, a few weeks ago when you were doing your review of part nine, okay, but Zelensky appears in part nine. He's sitting there typing away at a typewriter when they find out that
I didn't.
That FDR died. You know, he's uncredited.
Spotlight.
Yeah, he's uncredited, but because of the whole Dead Eyes story and knowing who Zelensky is, I actually, when I was rewatching part nine, I noticed that he was there and I was like, wow. So, you know, and then when I was doing part 10 and they mentioned Zelensky, I'm like, oh, that's even greater. You know, because what that basically tells us is as much as Winters was complaining about Zelensky, you know, back in Crossroads, he ended up keeping him on as his assistant, even as he was moving up in the ranks, meaning that he trusted him so much to help him deal with all of his bureaucratic work that he needed to do. So I,
and you know, Winters is a loyal guy, so I feel like, you know, he's very loyal to his men, and by that point Zelensky would have been under the umbrella of his men, so I feel like he's going to be loyal to him.
That's true. And Winters actually gets excited. He goes, "Oh, great!" And then Nix looks at him and goes, "Well, what is that?" And he opens up the package and he pulls out a an accordion folder, basically, which has a whole bunch of different slots in it. And then Winters explains the story. He goes, "I ran into the regimental photographer. He said he had all these photographs of the 506 going all the way back to Tekoa. I traded him for a couple of Lugers." So, I mean, again, it's it shows once again Winters' love for Easy Company, that he was willing to, you know, we don't know how many spare Lugers are sitting around that Winters was able to pick up, but the fact that he was willing to trade two Lugers to a photographer to get all these pictures is great. Because you'd also think, you know, this photographer's been lugging around these pictures for 2 years, especially if some of them from.
It says, yeah. It says to me that Lugers are 10 a penny at this point. So Hubler shooting himself with his own Luger was even more for naught. Because he was, "Oh, God, Luger. And then they're just all around, they're just on street corners at this point. They're just all lit. The curbs are littered with Lugers. By the sounds of things,
it's very possible, but you know, it's not something that Hubler would have known.
No, sure, yeah, it's a shame in hindsight. It's always a shame.
That's true. But, very true.
More so.
You know, hey, we have all these Lugers, so I'm gonna trade them for some pictures. But again, it shows how much he loves the whole idea of, you know, of his men and seeing his men and things like that. So, yeah, it's just great the way that they show this to us. At this point, Nixon looks at them and goes, "Well, that's a bargain." You know, again, possibly showing the fact that you know, as far as your, as far as Nixon's concerned, it goes according to what you said, that there must be Lugers all around. You know.
Yeah, they're lousy with Lugers.
So at this point, you know, the two of them get a little chuckle out of that. And because, you know, Winters is able to easily pick out a picture of the two of them. You know, you'd think I was just given, let's say, 100 pictures. Again, I have no idea how many pictures are really in there. Okay. But he's able to flip through them so quickly and, you know, pinpoint the one that has a young picture of Nixon and Winters. So it's just very funny the way that they do that. Because, you know, again, the picture was taken how many months earlier? Maybe 10 months earlier in real life. So it's very interesting the way that they show that. And then Nixon decides to change the subject on him and goes, well, what do you think we do after this? He goes, well, I'm going to go get some breakfast. Nixon just gives him a little bit of a look. And he goes, no, after. Which I think is a great way for them to show that these guys know they're at the end of this journey in their life. You know, they've been at war for a year, and you know now it's time for them to move on. Which you know the you know when you think of World War II, again, this goes back to what we talked about the last time you were on. You know, when you think of World War II lasted 6 years, but you know, from D-Day till the end of the war was around a year. Okay, so you know the Allies were fighting for 6 years, but in the European theater, the Americans were pretty much only there for a little over a year. So it's an interesting way for them to you know to look at the whole of everything that happened. I mean, I know that you think that they need to you know mention a little more about the fact that the Brits were there longer, but.
It's fine. Everyone knows. It's just, yeah.
Right.
That's not what the show's about. I get it. It's about these part-timers showing up towards the end, practically finished, taking the glory.
Exactly. He goes, no, after. Now, when he says after, it reminded me, do you know what the famous iconic movie character uses the phrase after? Can you think of anyone?
It's in there, but I can't.
And it's from three years before you were born, if that helps.
84. A lot of films come out in 84. Just ask Todd.
That is true. I was going to go ahead.
I can't. Any more clues?
Any more clues? There were numerous sequels to this movie, but the first one is the only one that's good, and they recently started a TV show about it.
Beverly Hills Cop?
They have a TV show about Beverly Hills Cop?
I don't know. They might.
Oh, okay.
Lethal Weapon? I don't know.
Lethal Weapon was 87.
That's true. I get. Yeah, 87, another good year for films. That's like Robocop was 87. I can't think of what TV shows it's like recently based on films.
It deals with martial arts.
Oh, The Karate Kid.
Yes.
I haven't seen The Karate Kid.
You've never seen any of the films.
Wow. I've never seen anything in the karate universe. The KCU.
Interesting. Okay. Well, the bottom line is that Mr. Miyagi, when he first meets Daniel, he sees him and he goes, when are you going to fix the faucet? He goes, after. He goes, after what? He goes, after.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those films, like Alex Robinson hasn't seen Die Hard, but he knows Die Hard. I feel like I know The Karate Kid. I know the gist of it. I've seen the scenes. I know. Yeah, he kicks him. He's not supposed to kick him, but he kicks him. Okay. So I get it.
No, he sweeps the leg.
Sure, but it's a crane kick or something.
Yes, very good. That's right.
But it's like it's an illegal move, but he does it and he gets away with it, kind of thing.
Very good, very good. Yeah. Yes.
So yeah, I don't need to see it. I'm good.
Okay, apparently. In my opinion, the Karate Kid, the original Karate Kid, is the only one worth watching. You know, and the first.
And I wouldn't even do that.
And the first 5 minutes of the second one, because that was cut out of the script. It was the aftermath of the tournament. Oh, whatever, doesn't make a difference. I actually haven't seen Cobra Kai, so I can't tell you if that's a worthy continuation. Except for the fact that I know that the whole idea of Cobra Kai is that you know they've switched it. You know, the good guys are the bad guys, and the bad guys are the good guys. So, you know, Daniel LaRusso is not a good person in Cobra Kai, from what I understand. But who knows? But I digress.
I have no input on this.
Okay.
And I'm fine with that.
And Winterson responds to him and goes, "Well, it's funny you should mention it, because I had a meeting with Sink." "Really?" "Yeah. Yeah, he discussed the possibility of staying in the army?" "Yeah, yeah, as a career." "What'd you say?" "Then I'd think about it." And Nick just looks at him and goes, "Well, what do you think about New Jersey?" So that's going to be my first question to you, Jay. What do you know about New Jersey?
It's where The Sopranos is set. It's where Ben Hosley, the producer of the Blank Check podcast, is from. It's Copland, and it's just outside of New York City. Okay. I think that's New Jersey.
Copland also takes place in New Jersey.
It's where Kevin Smith's films are all set in New Jersey. I didn't know that you were born there. I thought you were Detroit. Yeah.
You don't pay attention.
I don't. It's very true. It's very true. You've been talking to my wife. I have no intention of visiting. I've been to New York. It's close enough. What do I think about New Jersey? Not much. I don't think about it.
Okay, that's fair. Do you know what number state it was? You know, when it was admitted to the Union, what number was it? There were 13.
I neither know nor care.
It's 1 through 13.
8.
It was number three.
Great. Okay.
Okay.
Good.
So Winters looks at him and goes, "New Jersey?" And then Nixon goes, "Yeah, there's a company in Nixon, New Jersey. It's called Nixon Nitration Works." So, again, I find it really funny the way that he mentions this. You know, because we all know that his name is Nixon. So, obviously, we know that Nixon is educated, and we know that he comes from a somewhat upper-class family. But now they're really letting the cat out of the bag with who Nixon is.
We didn't realize he was Lewis Nixon III.
That's right. That is correct. Nixon, New Jersey is named after Nixon's father. Or it's father or his grandfather?
Grandfather.
Nixon the first? Is Lewis Nixon the first?
Yeah. Yes, that's what I read, that it was named after his grandfather, Lewis Nixon, born 1861 in Virginia.
Okay, so you know, his grandfather was the founder of the Nixon Nitration Works during World War One. Okay, did you look up what the Nixon Nitration Works was?
It blew up. There was an explosion
The explosion happened 9 years after they opened it in 1915. The explosion happened in 1924. So it's currently located in present-day Edison, New Jersey. Edison, obviously named after Thomas Edison. It was a chemical processing plant that was built to supply gunpowder for World War One, and later on they transitioned to manufacturing nitrocellulose, which is basically plastics. and you know, they named their product Nixonoid or Nixonite. You know, again, using their name. On March 1st, 1924, there was a catastrophic explosion, yes, which basically leveled the tiny town of Nixon. There were 20 people killed, 100 injured, and 12 people that were originally missing. It destroyed over 40 buildings across several square miles. And the explosion was so loud and powerful that even 50 miles away, people heard the explosion, and there were windows in Manhattan and Brooklyn just across the river, which had windows that were shattered because the explosion was so big.
Oh.
So, yeah. And just to explain a little bit of what is going to happen later on, I mean, towards the end of this part, so you know, Winters will explain it to us, but Winters ends up starting to work there and becomes the general manager within 5 years of working there. And once again, yeah, shows Winters' leadership qualities, that he's able to pick up on the stuff very quickly. And Winters just looks at Nixon after he says it and goes, "Well, it sounds picturesque." He goes, "Yeah, well, oddly enough, I know the owners." Surprise, surprise. He goes, "Probably going to expect me to make something of myself. Thought maybe I drag you with me." He goes, "Are you offering me a job?" He goes, "Well, we'll see how you do in the interview. But you know, a man of your qualifications, I think we'd probably scrape something up commensurate with your current salary level. Yeah, I'll think about it. Because I really do appreciate it. Yeah, just think about it." He goes, "Yeah." And then Winters gets up and gets ready for, you know, goes on to the I guess diving board area of the dock. You know, goes to the edge of the dock and dives into the lake.
How well do you think Jason Statham would have done in the role of Winters?
Just in diver, the diving portion, meaning as is maybe a stuntman, or
I mean, as the whole thing, but just seeing Winters diving in made me think, like, hey, what, Statham could dive if they'd hired him purely based on his diving ability. Nothing wrong at all with the diving ability on display here, with Damian Lewis's diving ability. But I just made me think, like, Statham dived. He could dive. He was as British as Damian Lewis is supposed to be, playing this American character. But I don't know if Statham would have ever even tried to hide his accent.
I don't think so.
Could they have
gone Statham? I'm still... my mind is still...
I don't think so either.
Reeling from the fact that Rick Schroeder was originally supposed to play this character, you know, until Damian Lewis came in and interviewed for you know, sat for the role. They were going to give it to Rick Schroeder, and I think that would be a very interesting. I think Rick Schroeder's career would have changed completely had he been given this role in the end. I think it would have really maybe done for him what it did for Damian Lewis, maybe even more so.
Yeah,
but.
Well, it might have made him somebody I wouldn't have to look up who he is, because I don't know who Rick Schroeder is. I'm currently
Rick Schroeder was a child TV actor in the 80s, and he was on NYPD Blue for a few seasons.
Oh. You and I have discussed Project of his in the past. Crimson Tide, which... I didn't.
And I'm sure that I mentioned him. I'm sure I mentioned him at the time.
He didn't make it.
If you want, you can go back and listen to it again. But I don't know.
Probably. I sure could. That's one of those casts where, like, I, you know, we talked about George Dazunda being in that, and I didn't know who George Dazunda was, but he was like a good character actor that I should know.
That's right. And James Gandolfino, no one knew who was at the time either.
I knew, but when I watched Crimson Tide, I knew who James Gandolfini was.
When you watched it, you watched it the first time. Whereas I didn't know who Christopher Doors. You watched it right before we started talking about it. That was what, a year and a half ago. So it's obviously you knew James
Gandolfini. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, but I didn't know who George Zunder was or Rick Schroeder.
Well, because apparently you never saw Big Dick Instinct. You know, then you would know who George Zunder was.
Yeah.
Or Law and Order.
Exactly.
He was one of the original detectives on Law and Order.
Sure. But every time I'm now very familiar with when we covered Die Hard 2, Dennis Franz was obviously prevalent across all of that, and he wasn't an actor that I had seen in anything other than Die Hard 2 before. But now he keeps cropping up in a bunch of stuff. Like, I watched Blowout recently. I love Blowout.
Oh wow!
And Dennis Franz is great in Blowout.
Yes, I don't like his character that much, but he does a great job with it.
No, sure, but he's great playing it.
Yes. I agree. I do agree.
That can be said for a lot of the cast of Blowout. Like, there's all awful people. There's a lot of awful people in this film being played very well. Yes,
that's true. And then as the camera gives us a shot of Winters swimming in the lake, doing what looks like a breaststroke, you know, we get narration from Winters. He goes, "Job offers. Hard to fathom. And the war wasn't even over. I was still getting used to hot showers and morning swims." We'd entered Bavaria in early May with the hopes of capturing Berchtesgaden, this famous town high in the Alps. It was the Nazi Party's symbolic home, and the heads of the Third Reich had houses there. Although Hitler was dead, he apparently ordered the SS to make it their last stand, from which to mount a guerrilla resistance. And, you know, as we're hearing his explanation of things, so we see the guy's basically just waiting around getting ready for an assault. We even see Webster writing, which I think is a great little thing to do here, you know, to show us because Webster was the writer among them, and if I remember correctly, he's the first one who actually released a book about his experiences during World War II of the Men of Easy. You know, which later on a lot more.
Not just the experiences during World War II. Yeah, they said at the end of this episode he wrote a book about sharks. He wrote, which I've looked it up. It's Myth and Man Eater, the story of the shark. I've added it to my to read list. I'm going to track this book down and read it.
Well, and he also got lost at sea, so he probably found a shark. Yeah. See, there's a story you should write.
Maybe.
You know, what happened to Webster? You know, when on his quest to find a shark.
I'll read his book first.
Okay. Once you track it down and you read it, let me know how it was. I'm curious. Then we get a shot of two soldiers walking forward, one of them carrying a bazooka, and that's how this 5-minute segment ends. So, Jay, do you have anything else you want to say about the 5-minute segment to begin part 10 of this series?
So, yeah, this episode featured one of the few things, like, this is only my second time going through it, as I've said before. One of the bits that I remembered and was kind of waiting for it to happen was Sobel coming back and the salute the rank, not the man. I knew it was going to happen at some point, not like right at the very end. So I've just been saying, like, waiting. I know it's gonna be like later in it because Winters obviously needs to be promoted above Sobel. But yeah, it finally happened. So good. So had some closure on that one.
Okay, but it makes sense that they would have it at the very end because it's basically closing. Closing the gap, closing the circle.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Or completing the circle. I think that's the phrase you would use.
Absolutely, closing the loop. I think. Yeah.
Closing the loop. There you go. The loop. Not circle. It's same shape.
Sure. Yeah.
Same shape. Loop.
Yeah, well, it's all the same. Circle. It's fine.
Same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Potato, potato. Tomato, tomato. Right. Yeah. Again, it is nice to see David Schwimmer show up again. You know, and just to show his disdain for Winters and for the fact that Winters surpassed him.
Yeah.
In so many different ways.
I like Winters and everybody else has changed, but Sobel hasn't. Sobel is still the same guy.
Correct. Exactly. All right. So we've been avoiding this for 10 episodes so far with you, but today you will get the option and possibility of giving us your top five movies about brothers.
We've been avoiding it for 8 episodes. We were never going to do it for 1 or 2, but sure. Yes, I have my list. I was tempted to do a thing like rank my top 5 directing brothers and then my top 5 acting brothers. But I didn't know. Directing brothers I found it tricky. I couldn't find 5 that I really liked.
You have 1. The Coen brothers.
Coen's is number 1 certainly. But I mean there's also this brothers that didn't necessarily direct together.
The Scotts.
You got the Scotts, the Farrelly brothers, the Safdie brothers, the Russos. If you count the Zucker brothers, because they directed with as Zaz with Abrams in there as well. But I'm still like Zucker's are brothers and they made some good films. But I'm not doing that. And I was gonna like a thing about my acting brothers and then be like, and of course not the Quaits. but I'm not gonna. So my movies
what
with brothers.
What a surprise that Jay would not like something with a Quaid in it.
Yeah. And people who don't know me are going to assume it's the other Quaid I don't like, but it's not. It's the main one. Nothing against him. I really like Jack Quaid. Jack Quaid's great. But anyway.
I didn't even know. I didn't even think about the fact that that Dennis has directed anything. I'm sure he has, but
I don't know. I wasn't counting him as a director. I was counting him as an actor. I don't know. He might have, I don't know. Anyway, doesn't matter. Movies with brothers in them. Quite a few. It's a broad category. Hence why I initially suggested that as a joke. But there we are. We're here now. So, no honorable. I found number 5 the hardest to do as usual. So I'm going to put number 5 as Dead Man's Shoes, which I don't know if it's come up before in people's lists. I can't remember. But it's an excellent film.
Yes, it has. It has. Paddy mentioned it.
Good. Okay. So Paddy Considine and Toby Kebbell are brothers in that. And it's a very serious, very like hard-hitting film. Shane Meadows, I want to say, directed it. Of This Is England. Excellent little British film. Check it out. Don't read into it before you watch it. Just watch it. It's good. Number 4, honorable mention I'm going to throw out is Big Night, which was what I was debating putting in number 5. Big Night, a film I've only seen the one time, but I remember really enjoying it. Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci are brothers who run an Italian restaurant, and it's like over the course of one night. Excellent cast, excellent food, incredible looking food. This huge pasta monstrosity that the Binging with Babish YouTube channel made one of. And it's a behemoth. Number 4, this has definitely come up. The Great Muppet Caper. It's a Muppet film. I love Muppet films. But this one, just it's the brothers aspect of it that makes me like this so much. The fact that Fozzie and Kermit are twin brothers in it, and no one really mentions it. I love that. So I have to have that in number 4. Number 3, Gore Verbinski's Mouse Hunt. A delightful film to kick off Gore Verbinski's career, in which Lee Evans and Nathan Lane play brothers who inherit a factory, like a yarn clothing factory of some kind. There's a mouse in it, and hilarity ensues. Doesn't sound like a great film, is a great film, and looks better than any film like this should look. The cinematography of Mouse Hunt is incredible. The cast of Mouse Hunt is incredible. Mouse Hunt doesn't get the respect it should. It's wonderful. That's my number 3. Number 2, I can't imagine anybody else has put this anywhere on the list. Number 2 for me is Jurassic World. The kids in it are brothers, therefore it counts. I am a fan of the Jurassic franchise. The first one is the best film ever made. Yeah, I know, it's shocking, isn't it? It's I keep it on the down low. People don't know this about me, but I really like dinosaurs. The Jurassic World isn't and sharks, which you know I count sharks as being dinosaurs because they're older than trees. Sharks are older than trees. A ridiculous fact. Jurassic World, not a what I would call a great film, but a film I enjoy and I've seen a lot and will watch whenever it's on TV. And therefore, it works for this list. And number one, recent film. Number one for me is Sinners. I've seen it three times at this point. Never a bad time to watch Sinners. It gets better every time I watch it. I love it. The music, the look of everything, the story, the twists, it's just an incredible cinematic experience. And I will continue to watch it regularly. I think it is a beautiful film that I think should have won Best Picture. No offense to one battle after another, but Sinners to me is better.
I definitely agree with you on that. That between the two, it is a better movie. I have seen Sinners twice, and the first time I didn't really like it, and the second time I enjoyed it so much more. So
I've started listening to the score when I'm doing writing. I love the soundtrack. It's just a great film. It's just a great film. What more do you need?
And so one of these days I probably will see it again, and maybe it'll move up even higher on my list. But yes, that is a great great list. And now the question is if you would have done this back in, let's say, part three, okay, would your list, do you think your list would have been the exact same thing, or would have been different?
I think Sinners, I think I'd only seen once at that point. So it might not have been, it probably wouldn't have topped the list.
Okay.
I don't know. So maybe that wouldn't have been there, and Big Night would have made it into number five, and Jurassic World would be my number one.
Okay.
But there's also like Blues Brothers could have been on there. Sing Street's a great film of brothers. Darjeeling Limited, I love. Film from 2025, The Monkey, I enjoyed quite a bit, with like Theo James playing twin brothers. Wasn't going to make my list, but I thought about it. Slumdog Millionaire was on there. Logan Lucky is a fun film. I as classic musicals go, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers is one that I do enjoy quite a bit. It's very problematic, but I like the songs in it. And in like looking up films for this, this is a spoiler, I guess. Spoilers for The Prestige. The Prestige came up as a potential film about brothers. I love The Prestige. It's an excellent film. I don't think they're brothers, is my take on it. I don't think they're brothers. I think the machine worked. I think that he goes in the machine, and the machine worked. But I've heard Christopher Nolan be like, no, they're brothers. And me be like, I don't think you understand the film you made, Christopher Nolan. They're not brothers.
Well,
that's me.
Interesting that you actually think that Christopher Nolan might need to rethink things.
Just because he made the film doesn't mean he's right. You see, there's a shot of him in the bloody machine, and then after that, there's another one.
Yeah, but anyway. Who knows whether the machine works?
Makes sense to me. makes sense. So I would never could put The Prestige in a list of films about brothers. It just makes sense to me.
Okay.
It's not, and that's fine.
Okay, completely understandable. All right, so now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. And around and around and around the wheel goes. All right. Here's another one that I don't think you're... No.
Right. Finishing strong.
Well, you're not finishing yet, but yeah.
Sure, yeah.
You will be back for one more episode after this, so yeah.
I will be back.
But I guess at that point we won't have. Maybe I'll give you some trivia questions if I have a few left over. So you never.
The dregs.
Not the dregs. The ones that weren't chosen by the wheel. There's a difference.
See what the wheel is.
It's not by choice. Which ones are left.
It's by wheel. It's all by wheel.
Okay, this is a movie from 1956 about a true story of a British pilot who lost both of his legs and still managed to find a way for them to re-enlist him in order for him to be able to fight and fly a fighter plane during World War II.
RoboCop. No, it's not ringing any bells. I don't know.
Okay, so the first of all, it's the name of the main character is Douglas Bader, that it's based on, played by Kenneth Moore, and the book was written by Paul Brickhill. Now, do you recognize that name? I mean, it's not going to help you. It's not going to help you with the title of the movie. But do you know who Paul Brickhill? Ooh. What else did he write? I'll give you a hint. Go back in time 10 seasons. Know.
10. So what is it? Yes, The Great Escape.
Paul Brickhill wrote The Great Escape.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So apparently Paul Brickhill liked writing books about adversaries during World War II.
Sure.
He also wrote The Dam Busters, which you know, as I've mentioned, it was George Lucas's basis for the attack on the Death Star. Use the Dam Busters for that. So that's very cool. Okay, so the name of the movie is Reach for the Sky from 1952.
Okay, never heard of it. You could have said it's named after something Woody would say in Toy Story.
You know what?
I'd be like, oh, the film was called There's a Snake in My Boat.
You know, you are 100% right on that, and I didn't even think of it. It wasn't even something that went through.
The sequel. Somebody's poisoned the waterhole. Right. And there's a Tom Hanks connection. Come on. Yeah,
Jay, you're 100, you know, in hindsight, you were 100% right. All right, so Jay, would you...
I'd love to join your posse, boys, but first, gotta sing a little song.
All right, so Jay, would you like to tell everyone one more time, even though you still have another chance this
season? I will tell them again.
Where they can find Jay Quillett.
LifeVersusFilm.com is my personal blog. There is occasionally some writing there. At the time of writing, I've reviewed things recently to a couple of David Lynch stuff. And Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, is the podcast where I talk about Deep Blue Sea and things similar to Deep Blue Sea, including sharks, Rennie Harlan films, aquatic action, that kind of thing. So if you like the sound of any of that and aren't sick of me talking on podcasting on this show, then check me out over at Deep Blue Sea. The podcast.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on Facebook. So I will be back tomorrow with another guest. And once again, it's a broken up guest.
I will never apologize. They all must wait for me.
No need to apologize. I'll be back with Jay in just a few weeks as we we'll close out this season when we finish part 10. So until tomorrow, Kurahee!
Kurahee!